laugh, every smile and giggle would be free. If I had a big moonlight, we'd turn it back on every night, just so the dark could try and get some sleep. If I had a rocket ship, we'd go places really quick and have a time to stop and get ice cream. If I had a big giraffe, he'd have to take a real long bath. And that's why waterfalls are really neat. Stand out in the rain, only feel the drops we wanted to. If I had a wonderful, we could play out in the snow, never have to wear our socks and shoes. If I had a pot of luck, we wouldn't have to spend a buck, get all the stuff we needed for our sneeze. If I had everything, we wouldn't get wet in the rain, and riding waterfalls would be a breeze.
This is KZFR in Chico. We had a little dead air there. Song gave out on us. I'm pleased to welcome Mark Arix to the phone this afternoon. Mark is the author of a book called The Dreamt Land. It was recommended to me by Barbara Vlamis, who's the executive director of Aqualliance, Protecting North State Waters. I found it to be a page-turner, first of all, and a blood-boiler, second of all. Every time I read a chapter, I got more and more angry about the abuses of the water system that Mark describes. It's a history, it's a commentary on water and agriculture in California. And my questions tonight are based in part on a book club that Aqualliance established to discuss the book. It's finishing up a little bit later this week, and the members of the book club had a hand in preparing some of the questions I'll be asking tonight. Welcome, Mark Arix.
Hey, very nice to be with you. Nice to join the people of Chico, one of my favorite spots.
Great, thank you. Give us a little biography, please, Mark. You're a native Californian. You live and farm in Fresno. You've been a newspaper journalist. You've written a number of books. How did you get where you are?
Well, my grandfather was a survivor of the Armenian Genocide, landed in Fresno in 1920. He was a poet. That was his life's goal, and he ended up getting on his hands and knees, as all poets do, and started picking the fruits and vegetables of the San Joaquin Valley. After 3 years of doing that labor with his family, they were able to save enough money to buy a vineyard, Thompson seedless grape vineyard. Mm-hmm. Thompson seedless are what you made raisins out of. That farm was west of Fresno, and that's where my father was born. And by the time I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, we had lost the farm. We'd gotten rid of it. We went into the grocery store business. lost the grocery stores after Safeway and the other big chains came.
Sure. Yeah.
And then my dad bought a nightclub, the hottest rock and roll club between Fresno and San Francisco. In the summer of 1971, he brought in Chuck Berry, okay. who did his duck walk across the stage. So that was my growing up in Fresno, surrounded by farmland that had been our history, but by that time I was coming up, it wasn't. And it was a very strange place because I lived in suburbia, almost cut off from the whole agricultural experiment that we were doing.
And you're going to tell us more, I think, about how that land changed over time, as well as maybe a little bit about your Armenian roots. You were a journalist. You were with the L.A. Times. I don't know if you want to talk about it. You left the L.A. Times in part because of a dispute over how it was treating Armenian citizens, American Armenians. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, you know, I loved my time at the. I left Fresno in my early 20s, went back to Columbia University, got my master's in journalism, then started my journalism career at the Baltimore Evening Sun, home of H.L. Mencken.
Yes.
I'm not sure anybody. But he was a great, great force. I mean, we could have really used Mencken in these last 4 or 5 years to skewer the politicians in a way that no one is able to skewer them like Mencken. So I got a real East Coast experience and then came back home in the middle 80s. My mom had cancer, took care of her in Fresno, and then I got a job at the LA Times. And it was a great time to be at the LA Times because you could go off and literally, if you had a great story idea, you could ask for 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years to pursue just that single story. And I had a number of stories like that that I was able to do. And that became a kind of training ground for writing books because when those stories came out, the narratives often took up the front page, several pages on the inside. And so, you know, you really learn to be a writer there. And I had never really done a story. I did a couple little stories on the Armenian Americans who were coming. I mean, the Armenians who were coming from Iran and Beirut, Lebanon, coming, you know, during in the midst of the Iranian Revolution and also the war in Beirut. They were coming to Glendale. And so I wrote some pieces, but I had written this piece about the Armenian genocide, and which, by the way, Biden was the first president to recognize
yes. mm-hmm.
the reality, the fact of this thing. It had been denied by Turkey for a century, still
yes.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this story, and the editor killed the story. I'd never had a story killed. I hardly had stories changed at the LA Times. And he killed it based on the rationale that I was Armenian.
And huh.
That seems so absurd to me because we had Latinos covering the border. We had Jews based in Jerusalem covering the Middle East. You know, we had African Americans covering the Deep South. I mean, who knew that all of a sudden identity politics would play out in such a way that they would kill my story based on that? And it became a big controversy. And I ended up leaving the paper after the Armenians of Los Angeles ended up boycotting the L.A. Times and canceling their subscription. So it was a big deal. But the nice thing was it got me more committed to my book career, writing books. And so in a way, it was a good thing.
And you've done a lot of tromping around in the Central Valley, elsewhere. A lot of the Central Valley. Work led to The Dreamt Land. How did you come to write the book?
So my first book was about my father's unsolved murder, our journey out of genocide, what Fresno was all about. So literally my first book took place in our backyard, okay? And then the second book, I happened during a flood of 1996, 97. 97, 98. The rivers, there was a huge snow melt that year, and the rivers that come out of the Sierra and cross the valley flooded. And what came back but a lake, Tulare Lake. I didn't know what Tulare Lake was. Mm-hmm. Tulare Lake happened to be the biggest body of fresh water west of the Mississippi. Okay? It was 880 square miles at the time of the Yokut Indians. They lived and fished its waters. They lived along its shores and fished the lake. The lake was a shallow lake, like a lot of interior lakes were in California before the dams. And the Yokut women could actually fish with their toes and pull out mussels and clams and things like that. So, and then the Chinese fishermen in the 1870s, 80s, they would fish for terrapin, and they would serve Tulare Lake terrapin as turtle soup at the finest San Francisco restaurants. This lake was gone, okay? Yeah, it had been drained dry by these cotton farmers who had actually come from the plantation south. They were chased out by the boll weevil, and in 1920, they landed in the Tulare Lake Basin, and they drained the last of that lake dry, or so they thought. In spite of the dams, in spite of the canals, in spite of all the diversions, every so often, in a heavy, heavy, heavy snow melt year, Tulare Lake comes back. Not all 880 square miles, but enough to think, when you climb up on one of these dikes or levees that they have used to reclaim that lake as farmland, when you climb up there and you look out, you think you're at the New Jersey shore. There are white caps whipping past telephone poles. And their shorebirds are trying to catch fish. And to think that just 2 weeks earlier, this was the richest cotton patch in America. So that scene created the spark to do a second book, which was The King of California, which I ended up doing with a very good friend of mine, Rick Wortsman. So I moved from Fresno to the larger valley. And my third book was a book called West of the West. It was a series of essays about California. And then the drought hit. So it was flood that inspired The King of California. It was drought that inspired The Dreamt Land. And that's when I put my boots on and decided, okay, I'm going to tackle water again. I swore after The King of California that I would not do another book on water. They're too difficult, too many facts. And how do you tell them in a compelling narrative, okay, and not get bogged down? But the drought was such, and things were happening, such madness was happening amid that drought, the very madness that's happening right now, fact, that I felt compelled to do that book.
Tell us a little more about the current madness.
You're seeing it in your own backyard, aren't you?
We are. I live up above Lake Oroville, Paradise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question now becomes, okay, we put 40,000 people on a geologic chimney there in the path of wildfire. What do we do now? Do we put 40,000 more there? Do we build anew? And these questions now, developers are looking at it, and they're designing water systems that are going to tap into Paradise and maybe bring it down to Chico. Mm-hmm. Chico's looking at not only that as an inducement to growth, but now we're looking at the pandemic and people wanting to leave the Bay Area, and they're looking at little old Chico. And what's going to happen to Chico? Is it going to sprawl out now like the San Fernando Valley sprawled out? It's a huge question confronting your listeners. And there's all sorts of political dynamics that are happening that want to push that growth. And yet you guys did something extraordinary 30, 40 years ago. You had an urban growth boundary, the Green Line. It was going to be the Red Line. But I think people thought that, oh, no, that's communist. We can't do that. So it was another line. And it became a way to preserve the agriculture and the Sacramento River. And it's been largely effective.
Yes.
And it's helped Chico revitalize its downtown, and it's given it its quirkiness. Okay, what happens when these forces are arrayed now that want to pave over all of that and go up to Paradise and maybe use Paradise as the energy there, that exurbia, to create a suburbia on the east side of Chico? All these questions are being raised now. And then you have this issue of the homeless there. I saw Naomi Klein wrote a piece recently, has written, I think, two or three pieces about Chico.
Yes.
She sees something extraordinary and unique happening there. I saw the same thing.
This was in your... I was just going to clarify for our listeners, you did do a piece on Paradise for California Sunday. I'll put the link to that up on our website if people want to check that out.
Sweet.
I thought the Naomi Klein, I thought she was a little extravagant in her treatment of Chico, but the facts were correct.
She's writing from afar. This is the problem. When you have people... I you know, she's not a native Californian. I don't know. You know, she, you know, people are flying in, taking their observations and flying out. There's a certain danger to that helicopter, you know, kind of parachuting in kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, sometimes when you're not close enough to it, you end up replacing that intimacy that a native would have of that story. You replace that intimacy with kind of a certain quality to the writing that makes it seem a little more certain than it really is.
Yes,
if I can say it that way.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of respect for her.
I do too. Oh yeah, no question. Yeah, on target. And our community is fighting at the moment over and fighting. Well, working on homeless. There have been commissions and a commission in the last several weeks that's working on problems long overdue of finding a campground for the homeless. A judge has taken us to task, and we got both parties got an extension of that. So there are a few more weeks where we're hoping the city council will approve a campground for the homeless. That doesn't solve all of their problems, but it would be a lot better than moving them out, bulldozing the campsites in our parks.
And we've got Newsom announcing a $12 billion funding to jump upon the Home Key, Room Key project that's already housed a lot of homeless up and down the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it may be that this pandemic, you know, you never let a disaster go to waste.
Yes.
It may be that this pandemic allows us to tackle homelessness.
Winston Churchill said something like that. You know,
yes, he did.
Never waste a good disaster.
Yeah, yes. No. We got, you know, oftentimes we don't even know we're stealing. I think it was Faulkner who said the past is never the past, or some version of that.
Yes.
And then we have this other thing where Mark Twain says, you know, whiskey's for, you know, fighting, water's for fighting, whiskey's for drinking, or something like that.
Right.
He never said that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, don't let a good quote go to waste.
Exactly. I wonder if we could jump back. I particularly enjoyed your chapters on the Fathers of Extraction. A lot of California history that I didn't know. You go back to 1769, and this is just a long tradition of extracting the water, extracting agriculture, the value of the land. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, and it just kind of dominates the state today.
Well, the simple thing would have been to just go back to the gold rush and to see how that culture of extraction played out. It played out in environmental degradation, so much so that the rivers were polluted, and farmers that were farming the alluvial plain of the rivers in the 1860s and 70s, they were being silted out. They were being polluted. And so farmers sued the big gold companies, mining companies, and actually prevailed in a Supreme Court case. Could have started there and could have made the argument that the supercharged way that California began in the gold rush, that culture, that ethos of extraction continues today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just now the land and agriculture and sprawl. That would have been the simple place to start. But really, when you look at the bending of resources in California, the real first extraction of a resource in California is the extraction, the taking of the body of the native Californian.
Mm-hmm.
When the missions took those bodies, and we could have a whole debate whether that was slavery, whether the disappearance, the erasure of the native population was a genocide, which I happen to believe it was. It wasn't as perfect as the Holocaust to come. It didn't have those mechanisms and means. But what it accomplished, the erasure of an entire civilization, was a genocide. So to begin this history of looking at the extraction, to understand what's going on the land of California today, you have to look back at our DNA, our roots. It begins with the missions and what happened to the Indians. It goes to the gold rush. And then out of the gold rush, something fascinating happens. The industrialists who made the most money off of gold, the few that made the ton of money off of gold, a lot of them were living on Nob Hill in San Francisco.
Yes.
And they decided, well, okay, what's the next resource to mine? And they looked to the hinterlands of California, and they saw the farm ground. And that's when they started buying up huge swaths of the Central Valley. I'm talking hundreds of thousands of acres in the hands of one man. 9 million acres, or so, no, yeah, 6 to 7 million acres in the hands of a dozen men.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did is they decided, because they're industrialists, they're going to plant a single crop, and that crop was wheat. So by the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, California was producing more wheat than any place in the world, and it was a prized wheat that the people in Europe loved. So one such industrialist was named Isaac Friedlander. He was known as the Wheat King, giant of a man. I mean, physically a giant, too. 6'7", weighed more than 300 pounds. They said his stride was double the stride of a normal man's. And he bought up hundreds of thousands of acres and industrialized the growing of wheat. He used some of the flow of the rivers. He also counted on some rain. Created this wheat that was called, I think, California Velvet or White Velvet, and he had this fleet of clipper ships that would then sail this wheat to Liverpool, and Europe went crazy over this wheat. The problem with the industrial wheat growers was that they had a monoculture of wheat, and wheat stole certain things from the earth, and the wheat started to wither. And as fast as we grew that wheat culture, it came down. And this is a fascinating period, because by about 1915, actually it starts at around 1880, 1890, but it picks up around 1910, 1915. You start seeing these huge concentrations of land holdings that these industrialists have, and they start selling it off to smaller farmers. And these farmers are growing comes the myth of California. They're growing the fruits and vegetables, okay, and nuts. This is the rise of the citrus culture in LA, okay. This is the rise in Northern California of all these orchards. I mean, John Muir himself was farming his father-in-law's incredibly diverse orchards in Northern California. This was a great period where the land was broken up into smaller units, and we actually had a kind of Jeffersonian model of small agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1920, the year my grandfather arrives here, we see the turbine pump get invented. And this is a huge, huge factor in what becomes a new kind of extraction. Let me explain that.
Let me interrupt for just a second to tell people you're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. My guest is Mark Erics. He's the author of Dreamt Land. It's about water and agriculture in the West. And we're just about to get into the water issue. The creation of those small farms, the buying up of vast acreage. There's not enough water to grow on all those acres. So tell us, please, about the extraction, how it begins with the turbines and the dikes and the sluicing and the dams and so forth.
Yes, exactly. By 1920, most of the river flow in the San Joaquin Valley. There are five rivers there, right, principally. There's the San Joaquin and its tributaries. There's the Kings River. These are huge rivers, not as big as the Sacramento and its tributaries, but, you know, good size rivers. There's the San Joaquin, the Kings, the Cahuilla, the Tule, and the Kern. And by the 1920s, the flow of those rivers has been completely appropriated by agriculture. Not 50%, not 70%, not 90%, but 98% of the flow was siphoned off the main stem of those rivers into canals and ditches and sent to agriculture. Now, this was an overreach to begin with. We should have kept 40% of the flow in the rivers for nature. We would have created a very different California. Instead, we took it all and we industrialized that water. And it went to smaller operators at first, but then bigger and bigger ones. And an argument on their behalf is that they were farming the easy flow of the rivers on good sandy loam, the alluvial plain. But what happens with the advent of the groundwater pump is that the footprint of agriculture goes beyond the prime soil, and then they start pumping water out of the earth to irrigate mediocre soil. And the footprint of agriculture expands. By the mid-19 to late 1920s, it expands to a point that the turbine pump can't even reach anymore. Mm-hmm. So much water has been drawn out of the earth that the aquifer has dropped hundreds of feet, and the land is dropping now. The actual land is sinking. Subsidence. A drought hits in the 1920s. It's a historic drought. And all of a sudden, all these farms that went on land that was an overreach are drying up. So the valley has a choice. Either you let those farms dry up and you become more sustainable, or what you do is you make a political argument that we need to steal a river. Give us the flow of one of those northern rivers so we can prop up an overreach of agriculture in the middle of the state. And that became the origins of the Central Valley Project, which dammed up all the rivers of the north, major ones, created, a dam on Mount Shasta, near Mount Shasta. And we took the flood flows of the Sacramento River and sent them to the middle of California. Then we took the San Joaquin River, which was in the middle of the state, and we sent its flows all the way to Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. So we killed the San Joaquin River, sent its flows 150 miles south, and to replace the San Joaquin River's flow, we brought in the excess of the Sacramento River. Really, a kind of engineering that had been never done by man in the history of the world. They got the idea from where? They got the idea of stealing a river from Los Angeles, which, you know, remember, this is taking place in the 1930s. In the early 1900s, L.A., looking at its growth, said, our little L.A. river can't grow L.A. into the metropolis we want. We need to go 230 miles up and over into the Owens Valley and steal their river. So when the San Joaquin Valley had its drought and needed to bring in water, they used the example of L.A. This is how the theft of water begins, okay? Mm-hmm. To support a kind of growth, whether it be city growth or agricultural growth, to support a kind of growth that is really unsustainable. But they find a way to buy themselves more time. Now, if we look at current day, we see how the footprint of agriculture, like the footprint of suburbia, has gone from places where it made sense to places where it made a little less sense to now places, ground, that makes no sense at all.
You write also about the evolution of pumping. Just as the turbines were not successful at getting deeper, there are better and better pumps that develop. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Oh, yeah. You've got pumps now. They go from 50 horsepower to 100 horsepower to 200 horsepower to 400 horsepower. You know, and you have different pumps for different kinds of land. On the east side of the valley, you have a different kind of land. It's a little rockier, so you have to do a different kind of extraction. In the middle of the valley, where you have these nice rivers that are flowing and recharging the groundwater, you can get by with an old-fashioned pump. On the west side, where there are no rivers, you have to go deep into the earth, 2,500 feet, to extract that water. These are industrial pumps of another magnitude. So this is what we've created, and it's a madness. So when the drought of 2014 hits, we cannot keep up. We have now created this drip irrigation, which sounds like a very wise thing to do, man. Drip irrigation is a very efficient kind of watering. But drip has a problem. The old furrow irrigation, it would evaporate, but also furrow irrigation ended up recharging the aquifer after it had watered the trees and the vines and the cotton. It would then go down and recharge the aquifer. Drip irrigation didn't recharge the aquifer, even though it was more precise. Also, drip allowed you to take the footprint of agriculture now beyond mediocre land to actually junk ground, and ground that was uphill because of furrow, because it doesn't go uphill. So we started seeing the footprint of agriculture go on land that not even dairy cows belonged on. And it went uphill into rocky terrain because that drip line could deliver a precise dose of water and nutrients and chemicals to the root zone. So now we have orchards, almond orchards, 1.5 million and more. And many of them are grown on ground that doesn't deserve to have an orchard, but it can be grown there because we're almost farming it like hydroponics. We're delivering the water to the root zone, and the dirt's there simply to stand up the tree. But this is the absurdity that I saw in this last drought. And I call it the last drought, but I don't know that it's the last drought. It may be that the drought we're seeing now is simply an extension of that drought, that we're in a 10-year drought pattern, maybe 15, and occasionally it gets broken up by a flood year or so.
Mark Arix, where do annual vegetables and crops fit into the picture, as opposed to trees that run for 5 to 25 years producing crop and demanding water every year?
Yeah, so what we've done is, and it makes sense from the farmer's bottom line, he's taking cotton and he's taking, he's taking principally cotton, which shouldn't have been grown in California. It's a surplus crop worldwide. And we're going to use the great land that we have to support cotton. Same with dairies. We have these mega dairies. Do we use our great land and our great water to support mega dairies that are polluting the aquifer and also polluting the air? These are questions that we're confronted with now. Our water is of such value, our land, the primo land, is of such value that we have to do an agriculture that makes sense. So I understand from an economic standpoint why they're planting so many trees. But what that means is in a drought, when you've got an orchard that lives for 25 years and you're in the midst of a drought, you can't just stop watering your tree. So the water demand, as we went from annual crops to permanent crops, is hardened. It's more, you don't have the ability to not plant in a drought year. So now you have to go deeper into the aquifer. And you have to do this water marketing where the rich almond and pistachio and mandarin growers here in this part of the valley, the southern, are actually going up north to your area and beyond to the rice country and buying up excess water of the Sacramento, trying to bring it through the delta to support this nut culture.
And the notion of excess water up here.
Go ahead. It's excess in the eyes of these guys down here. You know, you still your groundwater table is still pretty damn high up there. In flood years, it's certainly excess. But you're right. And so the idea is farmers in the South team up with farmers in the North, and they say, look, you're not making so much money off your rice. Mm-hmm. Partner up with us. Yeah. So these are the kinds of things that are happening to stave off, to keep from a day of reckoning. But the day of reckoning is coming, because we now have climate change hitching on to our own crazy climate. You know, we don't need climate change in California to have long, long periods of drought broken up by extreme
right.
flooding.
Yeah.
But the two are hitching up now, and we're in a kind of place that we've never been, you know, staring down at things we've never stared down at before. And so what is going to become? Are we going to finally face the limits of our resources? You know, and what's impinging on all this is we have a supposed law that's going to come on the into effect, which is called the SGMA.
SGMA, yes.
Yeah, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And, you know, SGMA, if it's working, in my valley alone, the San Joaquin Valley, 6 million acres of farmland, if SGMA works the way it should work, 1.5 million of those acres will be idled. The worst ground with the worst groundwater. They'll be idled. We'll have 4.5 million acres of strong agriculture remaining. And ironically, we would be going back to a decision that we should have made from the get-go, which is, hey, the rivers flow, we should only take 60 to 70% of it.
Mm-hmm.
So this will, if it's done. Now, I have some serious doubts.
Yes.
The Department
yes.
of Water Resources uh-huh. has the will, the guts, the manpower to put this in place.
And whether SGMA can be apolitical, which seems a dubious proposition at best.
I think you're right.
Wondered if we could talk a little bit about engineering. On this program, we interviewed Michael Heusman, who writes about techno fixes and says there's no magic techno fix that's going to solve climate change or drought. I did read with interest recently Elizabeth Colbert's new book, White Sky, in which she argues, and I have some doubts about this, that we may have to engineer out our way out of engineered problems. So with the state water project and the federal project, we engineered ourselves into this dilemma. Do you see any way in which we can engineer our way out of it? I'll just give one more example, then listen to your answer. We have the Sites Reservoir, which is proposed for Northern California, which would not produce any new water. It would store water. And our friends in Aqua Alliance tell us the water they're going to store is going to be poisoned by heavy metals coming out of the California range and may be unfit to put back in the Sacramento. Another effort, though, at engineering our way out of a dilemma. Do you see any way in which engineering can solve problems at this point?
Well, I never bet against engineering. I never bet against California's ability to reinvent itself.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I think that the only way out of this is to look at our ambition, what we're going to be. You know, in my lifetime, we've gone from, 13 million Californians to 40 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other day, it came out, this census, that we've lost 180,000. And everybody was, oh, how could this be? California's lost 180,000 people.
Right.
Well, it may be that that's actually could be somewhat of a positive. I don't know. There's a lot of interesting things happening.
The media persist on seeing growth as a healthy
that's right. Now, there are implications for immigration on that, for the people in poverty, all that kind of stuff. But I saw what happened in the valley here. It was very hard for the United Farm Workers to get a foothold, to get the leverage they needed to be mm-hmm. effective in the fields, because there was a constant flow of new farm workers coming who were willing to undercut those farmers and their wages.
Yes.
Okay. And the big farmer benefited from that. A ready flow. He kept going deeper and deeper into the rural heart of Mexico, bringing out workers, okay, to undercut the others in this herd. So it's a complicated argument fraught with all sorts of stuff, anti-immigration stuff, eugenics even, all that. I understand. But at some point, California has to look at its resources and see whether how big it can get. And we never are, you know, we have this notion that we got to build a bunch of more houses. Well, where are we building them at? We've got a quarter of our population living in the wildland urban interface right now. Mm-hmm. Right in the path, we're building thousands of homes in the path of wildfire, even as wildfire is taking down hundreds of other homes. It's just, so let's have an honest conversation about what can California be. Maybe it can't be 60 million people. Maybe it's, hey, we will be 60 million, but we're going to pave over all the farmland in the middle. We're going to just have suburbia. And then we'll grow our food somewhere else. Okay? Already our food that's grown here is being exported. So really, are we using our farmland for ourselves? So that's all this conversation, and we're just not having it. Okay? And climate change is... should be forcing us to have this conversation, to look at it all, and yet we're still very tribal. And I'm not talking, you know, the land of Jefferson where you're at.
Right.
I'm talking the tribal when it comes to north, south, and middle on the resources of water.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm talking with Mark Arricks, author of The Dreamt Land, a remarkable book. Strongly urge listeners to read it. Well, I wanted to ask a little bit on the current drought. Farmers will get only about 5% of their allocations this year through the state and federal water projects. So where's the 95% going to come from at this point?
From the earth. Even as we're contemplating what we're going to do with Sigma,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing the biggest farmers drilling more and more wells, going deeper into the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Those that can afford it will be buying water from the haves. So let me give you an example of what's going on right now. The king of California was about J.G. Boswell, the biggest cotton grower in the world. J.G. Boswell owns, if you could own, 10% of the King's River. He also gets a lot of water from the state water project. Okay. I say he. J.G. died not long after the book. His son is now running the company. And what the Boswells are doing is that they are selling their state water. It's probably about 60,000 acre feet in a good year. This year, not much. But they're selling it on an open market to farmers that are not on the state water project, that don't have good groundwater, and they're making $40-50 million in these sales. Well, okay, that's all fine, let's say. But what you should be doing as the Boswells, then you should be saying, hey, we're selling our state water, and we need to, in a proportionate way, reduce the footprint of our agriculture. It means fewer acres of cotton, fewer acres of tomatoes. But no, they're not doing that. They're saying, no, we're going to farm our same acreage. The way we're going to do it is we're to make up the difference of what we're selling by pumping deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pumping now 2,500 feet deep that the wells go. And they're pumping not that deep of water, but wherever the water is between the surface and below, you know, hundreds if not thousands of feet deep, drawing out this water. And the worst subsidence in California, if not America, if not the world, is in the Tulare Lake Basin around Corcoran, because they're pumping so much damn water out of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing an nth degree. I mean, the book documents the nth degree of extraction, the absurdity, the madness of growing more acres in a time of drought. And all we're seeing now is just a turn a little bit more in that direction with this new round of dryness.
Another king and queen of water are the Resniks, and I was interested to read recently in the Sacramento Bee that they gave, I think it was $250,000, I may be wrong on that figure, to the Newsom campaign. We're counting on the governor not to proceed with the tunnels, which he pledged originally, and to protect our, we're concerned about North State waters. What do you see the influence of people like the Resnicks and other kings and queens of agriculture in this year of drought, in these years of drought?
The Resnicks are very complicated folks. I spent, that book is, it's a 520-page narrative, and I would say maybe 30% of it is on the Resnicks. They are the new kings, the pomegranate princess and the nut king. And they are complicated because, they're farming from Beverly Hills. they have some company towns up and over the hill in the San Joaquin Valley. And late, but not too late, they've started to give a tremendous amount of philanthropy to those company towns of theirs, and doing things in a way that's not just paycheck philanthropy. You know, they're actually getting involved. Linda's designing schools to try to help Latino kids. So it's complex. A cynic can say they're just simply trying to wash away their guilt. And it could be true. I mean, we wouldn't have a library in America or a museum in America if the rich weren't washing away their guilt. So there's some of that going on. I think there's something a little more genuine also going on. And they're liberals. They happen to be a rare, the Resnicks are seen as carpetbaggers here in the valley because they came up and over the mountain. And they're liberals, where almost all the farmers are extreme right-wingers. So, at least the big ones are. So, they're a complicated pair. And, it's interesting. And they've spread money around politicians for years and years and years. They've been among the bigger donors to political campaigns.
Do you expect the single tunnel to go through fairly soon?
I punt on very few issues, but the tunnels in the Drempland, I felt that the two twin tunnels were wrong. Once I went to the Delta and I saw the footprint of those tunnels and what they were going to do to those very lovely farming communities that take their water straight out of the Delta, I thought this is way too big shadow here. The single one I haven't looked at in enough detail to see if it's small enough not to have that effect, but not big enough to where it's going to end up shipping more water to farms that should not have any more water, because we already are in an excess of agriculture. Okay, we're talking about having to reduce the footprint of agriculture by 1.5 million acres in the San Joaquin Valley alone. If that's one tunnel ends up bringing water here that allows for those that farmland to continue to be farmed, then it's a mistake. Mm-hmm. We got a nut. These almond growers had 25 years where they thought that they could escape a bottom line that no farmer has ever escaped in California, and that is glut. Okay, bust. My grandfather came here immediately. He came here in the 1920s. There was a raisin bust that ended up, all these vineyard paper millionaires, they just went belly up. Every crop, because of the way farmers do it, they look at other farmers, they say, wow, that dude's making a killing. I'm going to plant some of those. By the time they plant them and they're producing, they see that it's no longer a killing. Well, the almonds went a long time. They were making a killing. But now, the price of almonds has come down by half. It was $5 a pound to the grower, something that lusty almost. And now it's $1.80, $1.92, something like that. We've got too many damn almonds.
And so we go for pistachios, which became...
Well, that's what they're going to do. Yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah.
What they're going to do is they're going to take out the almond and plant the pistachio. The pistachio has a couple of virtues. One, it's an alternate bearer. That means in 1 year it's heavy, 1 year it's light. The other thing about the pistachio is, instead of having, you know, right now 1.6 million acres of almonds, we have, I don't know, 300,000 acres of pistachios, maybe more. It might be a little fuzzy on that number. The pistachio also doesn't need as much water as the almond. Mm-hmm. You can get by with maybe 30% less. The other thing about the pistachio is it tolerates salt. So as the salt is coming up to the surface as a byproduct of irrigation, not unlike the salting of Mesopotamia, pistachio can withstand that longer.
We wanted to ask about a bald question. We sort of can guess at some of your answers. If you were the king of California water, if you were in charge of water policy, what would be the big changes you would make in the short or the long range, and would you expect to be tarred and feathered for your efforts?
Oh, yeah. I think the first thing is I'd implement an effective SGMA program. Okay, that's mm-hmm. going to get you halfway toward some sense of sustainability. That water that's saved, I don't want to see that water go from farmland to suburbia. I want to see it mm-hmm. kept in this area and the rivers running with more of the water. Okay, that's number one. Number two, happy cows don't exist in California, in spite of those old commercials. Yeah. Too hot here in the central San Joaquin Valley. Cows need to go elsewhere. I know that's going to really upset my Azorean, Portuguese, and Dutch friends. But they came up and over the mountain from L.A. when suburbia bought them out in Chino and places like that. And now they've had a 30, 40-year experiment here, and now they need to move somewhere else where it's cooler and the water and the ground aren't worth so much. Also, that means we would stop growing as much silage, alfalfa, haze,
right.
Corn, which are water guzzlers. Okay? It would also help with air pollution and groundwater pollution. A tough one, we could keep our smaller dairies, some beautiful smaller dairies around. But these 20, 25,000 head dairies, I mean, come on, that's absurd. Let's see what else. I think we need to do a better job of taking care of our forests, because those are our snow fields and our water fields. There may be a role for desalinization. It's very controversial. It's got a lot of downsides to it. There may be. And I think we need to have the state, just like it's getting involved in groundwater, it needs to get involved in land use. You know, we think of ourselves as a progressive state, but really it's the libertarian streak in California that prevails. We have allowed the counties to make all the calls on growth, and that is how the ridge top got populated with 40,000 people. Okay. Butte County made some horrible decisions, the 4x4ing of that land, where a guy comes in and says, hey, I bought this land, I want to divide it into four tracks. And he sells one of the tracks to his buddy, and his buddy takes that one track and says, hey, I want to divide mine into four. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon the 4x4ing is going crazy, and you've got no way out in a fire.
Yeah.
That's what happened, as you guys all well know. The state needs to get involved in some of these decision-makings, deciding where housing should and should not go.
We're about out of time, Mark Erics. We really appreciate your comments. We look forward. Do you have a project in the wings that we should know about?
I got a couple magazine pieces. I got a novel I'm working on. That way I don't piss off anybody, excuse my French. They people can say, you know, why did you write about me? And I said, that's not you. That's a composite of you. You know what I mean? So my family will be happier. The farmers will be happier. It'll be nice. I'll just... You know, I'll fictionalize things, but it'll all be very real. You know, so
sure.
I think that's where I'm going next. I bent nonfiction about as far as you can bend it in books. So, but anyhow, it was a pleasure being with you guys.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, we very much appreciate it. And the book. The book is Dreamt Land. Get a copy, listeners. Mark Arricks, thank you for being with us on Ecotopia tonight.
Thanks, Stephen. Mm-hmm. Yes, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. I want to tell you that coming up in just a few minutes, Bobby Tryon will be here with North State Give and Take. Her guest will be John Mertz, who is deeply engaged in Butte Creek preservation. Talking about the salmon runs, we've had him on Ecotopia as well. Also then, stay tuned at 6:30. It's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive and a whole evening of good stuff coming up on KZFR. Ecotopia is available. You can check our website. It's ecotopiakzefr.org, where we archive our programs. We include some notes from those programs as well as recordings. We also now podcast. We podcast via Anchor, Spotify, Google, Apple, and a variety of other sources. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Next week, we'll be talking about a film called The Dark Hobby that looks at the aquarium extraction trade in Hawaii. There's a new film called The Dark Hobby, which Susan and I have viewed. And we'll talk with the producer of that film and two of the people on the film who talk about the sentience of fish that they feel, that they think, that they have. They're a lot smarter than we thought. And about the damage being done to the reefs by extraction of aquarium fish. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia.
You are the new.
So as a consequence, we've been pushing to really want them to open up. If nothing else, it seemed like a little thing, but the Park Commission used to be on Channel 11, you know, which is our home. They've gone to a couple different internet applications that have supposedly allowed for some interface, but it's not a good place to be if you're trying to, in fact.